And hello to all you faithful patrons of the Shea Bippy Bar. I am coming to you today with my good friend, as always, and we are thrilled to be back here at the bar, pulling up and being able to share an adult beverage or two and maybe talk about a very, very good film, one of our favorites, and something that the public clamored for, and we're certainly all about giving the public exactly what they want here on Shea Bippy. So welcome back to the Shea Bippy Mob Bar. And of course, as always, I am joined by my good friend. He is the Jimmy Whispers. He is the Sonny to my Jimmy Whispers, I should say, the incomparable Thomas Murphy. Murph, welcome back to the bar, my friend.
Man, it is good to be back at the bar. Jesus, it's been too long. And yes, the public has spoken. We knew, Mike knew when he put this poll up, which we were going to do. We were going to, it's the hot poll, and you had some great choices out there. But we knew it, we both knew it. As soon as I saw the name, he knew it as soon, before he typed it, that Heat would be the film that you all wanted us to break down.
Yeah, and from a public perspective, we kind of knew, first of all, this one was going to be the most popular of the three films that we put up there on the poll. And second of all, I mean, if there's a holy trinity of Italian-American actors out there in the pantheon of American film, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are the father and the son, and you can probably go back and forth as to who should take what role, but they're definitely up there, and I think the third slot would probably be taken by Frank Sinatra. Not that saying
yeah,
that there aren't
the
Italian...
Ghost.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that there aren't Italian-American actors that probably were more accomplished actors
right.
than Sinatra, but, I mean, come on, who's going to tell Frank he's not up there in the top
That's
three?
It.
I mean, you
not
just
me.
Can't do it. No matter what the guy did, he was great at it, he was cool, and just... absolutely revered. So you want to talk about the main three, that's it. But Al Pacino and Robert De Niro coming together for really the first time on film. Godfather Part II was the first time that they were actually in a movie together, but did not share any screen time. This in 1995, a film that was written, produced, and directed by Michael Mann, stars Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Robert De Niro playing Neil McCauley, Al Pacino playing Vincent Hanna. Vincent Hanna is an LAPD detective. Robert De Niro is, of course, a career criminal in Neil McCauley. So this one was definitely, I think, probably one of the most anticipated movies of the 90s. The fact that Al Pacino and Robert De Niro were actually going to come together and be on screen at the same time was something that I know from growing up in an Italian household and watching these guys, this was big. This was really, really big. And it was a film that I think a lot of people were waiting for. And despite of what some people might say, I don't think it disappointed in the least. I thought this lived up to the hype. And I really do consider this one of my favorite films, not only in the genre, but also of all time for that reason. Simply because the acting and the cast in this was phenomenal. Michael Mann really did a great job with casting in this.
He did. It was a fantastic job by Michael. Nobody had ever expected De Niro, or they'd waited and waited, but they didn't think that this would be the movie that they would do together. Now, from what I've heard, Pacino was actually thought of to play Neil McCauley in this movie, and then Mann talked him into playing Vincent. Did you hear any of that when you were searching for your tidbits?
Absolutely. That is 100% right. When they first, Michael Mann wanted Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in this film. That was mm-hmm. That was absolutely his first choice. Believe it or not, it could have taken some different combinations and permutations. If De Niro or Pacino had declined their roles, then Mann wasn't going to have either one of them. Believe it or not, his fallbacks were having Harrison Ford play Vincent Hanna and Mel Gibson, believe it or not, play Neil McCauley. So that could have been a different film. It could have been a different flavor and the two great yep. actors, but it definitely could have taken on a different life of its own. But originally, when Mann had thought about what was going to be the case, and Pacino first read the script, he identified more with the McCauley character, and Michael Mann tried to convince him and say, look, no, this is, I have you in mind for the Vincent Hanna character. it was actually a character, and I'll get into a little bit, you know, as to why, but it was so tailor-made for the flamboyant style that Al Pacino brings to his movie roles. And I think De Niro was so well-suited for the Macaulay role, just an understated, very matter-of-fact type performance for Robert De Niro. So some great work done by two of the greatest to ever step in front of a camera. And again, like I said, I really don't think this disappointed. It was actually, believe it or not, this story was based on a true story. Former Chicago police officer Chuck Adamson had pursued a criminal named Macaulay in a very similar fashion to what you see in the movie. So that was, this was happened in the 1960s. Obviously, the film was updated for a more modern audience, but that was really the story behind Mann writing this project. And he even tried to incorporate a lot of what you saw in a 1989 television series called L.A. Takedown. And Mann did shoot a pilot and a couple of episodes. It never really took off, but that was going to be the seedlings of what eventually became this movie, Heat. And a little interesting tidbit on L.A. Takedown, Murph. Xander Berkeley, who plays Ralph in the movie, who's a small role, but it's a memorable scene. I'm sure we'll get into that in a little bit. The guy that's fooling around with Pacino's wife. Xander Berkeley actually played Wayne Grow, or the part of Wayne Grow, in L.A. Takedown when they shot the original series. So he ended up coming full circle, and Xander ended up being in this movie. For those of you who don't know Xander Berkeley, he's a character actor that you've seen tons of times, may not know his his name, but you definitely know his face. You've seen him in movies like Terminator 2, A Few Good Men. He played a small role. For those of you that are fans like myself and my good friend Ian Glendon of the TV show 24, he played George Mason, the first head of CTU in the first couple of seasons. He played in Air Force One. Yeah, he played in Air Force One. He played a crooked lost my train of thought there. America played a crooked Secret Service agent that betrayed Harrison Ford's presidency. So it was interesting to read that. That's something I did not know, because I had no knowledge of L.A. Takedown before doing the research for this movie. But always, it never disappoints. Anytime we're here at the Bippy, we always get new little pieces of tidbit that that we love, and our listeners seem to like them too.
But it just goes to show that the power that Michael Mann wielded at that time in Hollywood, you know, to bring this cast of characters together, not just Pacino and De Niro, getting them on screen together for the first time ever, but, you know, Val Kilmer, a young Ashley Judd, Natalie Portman, you know, John Voight, you know, I always mispronounce his name, McKelty Williamson. It's, you know, Dennis Hybart. There's so, I mean, you can go all the way down the entire cast of this film and say, wow, Hank Azaria playing a bit part, and Henry Rollins.
Michael Sizemore.
Sizemore. There you go. Yeah. Sizemore is in this movie. And all the way
Tom
down,
Sizemore,
you know.
Excuse me, not Michael Sizemore. Yeah. Tom Sizemore.
Yep, Tom.
He plays Michael Cerrito in the movie. But
yeah. Right. You know, Tone Loc and Ricky Harris playing the Tarina brothers. I mean, it's just fantastic. It was just at that point, you know, if somebody, you know, went on a speakerphone and said, Michael Mann on line two, you dropped whatever you were doing and you picked up that phone, because that's what he was doing in Hollywood at this time. And I've got to say, this is one of my favorite freaking movies that he has ever done. It was gritty. It was intelligent. It sucked you in the first 20 minutes of the movie and never let you go. And I really have to say, I think this is, you know, outside of The Godfather, is my favorite Al Pacino freaking character. Why? Because it's got a great ass. That's why. And that's what this character has, and that's what this movie has. It's got a great ass, and I've got my head all the way up it.
Absolutely. You know that line was not even in the script. That was Al Pacino ad-libbing. And you can actually see it. If you look at the scene and you watch the scene, Hank Azaria's character just looks at him with like a quizzical look at first, and then immediately gets back into character. But he wasn't expecting that. That was just that was Pacino. Believe it or not, and I hinted at this when I gave my little synopsis early on about the movie, about a guy like Vincent Hanna and why Al Pacino was a better choice to play this than Robert De Niro. The original script called for Vincent Hanna to have a cocaine problem, which was one of the reasons why he was so bombastic and gave all of these outbursts over and over again and just spontaneously started yelling for no reason. I remember one of the first scenes in the movie, which is one of my favorite scenes, where he is talking to Ricky. He's talking to one of his informants, and that informant is there, and he's, you know, doing his thing, and he's trying to tell him that, oh, I got information for you, and Pacino just automatically just like grabs the table and just goes, "Get me all you got," and he just starts, you know, ranting
two or three times over again
about that exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was originally in the script, and I think that's the reason why Michael Mann thought that this was going to be the perfect role for Al Pacino, and he did play it very well. One of the big reasons why that cocaine habit was taken out of the script is because Mann and Pacino discussed it a little bit more, and Pacino, believe it or not, didn't want to be typecast into the whole cocaine type thing. He thought that still followed him around from Scarface all these years later, so he made the decision to kind of scale it back a little bit, and also he thought it took away from the sharp, you know, contrast between the character of Macaulay and Hanna just being so fixated on him. It made it, I think it made for a little bit better of a focused character going after his prey at that point.
Yeah, I agree. And it also lends to, you know, the difficulties that he had, you know, with his marriages. He was like on his, what, third marriage or something like that. And, you know, it was much better to have him so dedicated to his job that that's what was destroying his life, as opposed to, you know, the a drug angle. I'm so glad that that did not make it into this film. I really am. The fact that this job does eat apart a certain type of person, a certain kind of individual, and that because you become so engrossed in it that nothing else in your life seems to matter, and except when you can make time for it. And no, I'm glad that they went this way as opposed to, all I can see right now is the show. I don't know if any of you guys are out there watching City on a Hill. Great show.
Right.
It's fantastic, but why do I do this? Because I lose names. Who plays the detective in City on a Hill? Somebody tweeted at me later. Kevin Bacon. Moron Murphy. Kevin Bacon, who has a serious cocaine habit, and, you know, that's all I could have seen. And no, I'm glad they went this way. But no, Val Kilmer, you know, also plays a fantastic role in this movie. Chris Chiarellis, and he's another lifelong criminal, part of Robert De Niro's core crew. And he does have a problem. He's got a gambling problem, and that's why he needs these kind of things so often. But I'm going off page. You go ahead. Get us back on.
No, you're absolutely. I think you're really following along. I don't think you're that off base. I think part of the reason why this movie works so well is introducing the characters, and none of these characters are perfect characters. That's another brilliant thing about this movie. There's good and bad in every single one of these characters, all the main characters anyway, whether they be criminals or whether they be cops. And you really see that there is such a fine line between good and evil, and people walk that line all the time. It's not cut and dry in this film. And we've seen a lot of films that we've chronicled here, you know, whether it be Goodfellas or whether it be The Departed or some of the films that we've seen that Scorsese does. He is a brilliant, brilliant director of being able to walk that line. I think Mann did a great job with that in this. You mentioned the character of Chris Chiarellis. Believe it or not, again, Val Kilmer was the top choice. He always was the top choice for this because Michael Mann did want to work with him. The problem was, is Kilmer was actually filming Batman Forever at this point, and they weren't sure he was going to be able to get time off to be able to film extensively the way he wanted to. Kilmer was so determined to do that he just made it work, and that was the reason why he ended up getting the film. Otherwise, Mann's two top choices were going to be either Keanu Reeves or Johnny Depp, and both of them were very eager to do that. They were both eager to be in this film, but ultimately he went with Kilmer, and I think it was the right choice. I think Kilmer had that laid back malaise type attitude that yep. Chris Chehalis needed to have in order for him to be a sympathetic character. But you mentioned, you know, we mentioned Tom Sizemore and his role of Michael Chirito and coming in and being a dedicated family man, believe it or not, that was in this line of work simply because right. he loved engaging and being a part of something exciting. Danny Trejo was actually in this film long before people really knew who he was. He was a very, unknown character actor at the time. I mean, he was known by face, but nobody really knew him by name.
Right.
He was, believe it or not, he actually did spend some time in Folsom Prison, which lent in, and De Niro actually picked his brain a lot on mm-hmm. his experiences there to be able to have that as part of his backstory, because Neil McCauley was, you know, incarcerated in Folsom Prison as well. So the whole point in the movie Heat and the whole point in the title of the movie is a line that Robert De Niro repeats several times, and McCauley, meaning, I guess is a better way to put it, repeats several times throughout the movie, and that is, have nothing in your life that you cannot walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you spot the heat around the corner. And the heat
right.
essentially means law enforcement. And McCauley lives by this code. That's his personal conduct code. And he and his crew, whether it's Chehalis, whether it's Chirito, whether it's Trejo, whoever the guys that are with him, have to live by that code at the same time. And that is how they pull their jobs. They're very deliberate. They're very precisioned. They're timed. They constantly shout the time to one another. They know exactly how long they have to be able to do what they need to do, get in and get out. If it's not working, they have no problem with dropping everything
walking
and
away.
Getting up and moving on. And they do that in this movie, which is, you know, remarkable to see a gang like this that is trying to pull off jobs, and that's how they make their living, but ultimately they value their freedom above everything else, even
right.
more so than the money that they're trying to get. So that is the permeating theme throughout this whole type
and
of movie.
And it permeates with everybody in this movie. This isn't a single crew movie. This is two crews, okay? There's the crew that wear blue, the police crew, and then there's our gangsters, and they both basically have to live this same type of life. They both walk in the same circles, but not at the same pace, if you know what I'm talking about, folks. It's very two sides of the same coin, and that's the beauty in this movie. It shows you exactly what's going on. It shows you that, you know, Roger Van Zant, the upstanding stockbroker, whatever guy, is really, you know, he's dirty. He's a dirty guy,
yep.
just like everybody
yep.
else in this movie. He's a criminal, but he wears a white collar, and everybody, you know, he's got a secretary, and everybody, you know, bows down to him in his world. But he's a criminal. You know, I mean, the only person that is truly, you know, you see is what you get is Wayne Groh,
right.
played by Kevin Gage, fantastically played by Kevin Gage as just a sociopath. And I'm sure Mike's got that in his notes that he's going to get into. But other than that, no, you're right. There's so much of each other in these people as to, you know, where their paths split. We're not really sure. It just made this for an even better movie. I mean, you know, Hank Azaria, who plays, you know, a casino runner, for lack of, he manages a casino, but, you know, he's got a dirty past, and he's screwing around with Val Kilmer's wife, Ashley Judd. You know, that's about the only thing that I didn't like about this movie is how Michael Mann writes and directs for women. Not to get too feminist into this or anything, but they're very, you know, outskirtish. They're very, you know, the arm candy of, but that's just the way the movie was playing out. You know, it went to show the character of the other people in this. And it goes back to what Michael was just saying, is the fact that McCauley, he kind of broke his own rule, and that's what, you know, screwed everything up.
Right. Exactly. And at that moment, again, we bring it back to The Godfather, Murph. It became personal. It wasn't
right.
strictly business at that point. And that really went against everything that Macaulay was and everything that he tried to be. And it ended up being a fatal mistake. And we'll talk about yep. that a little bit down the line. But Macaulay pulls a job. The movie essentially opens up with Macaulay and his crew pulling a job, and they're out for money. There's no question about it. That's what they rob for. This is not a situation where, you know, they're doing this for, you know, for fun or for kicks or, you know, to have a high body count. This is actually a crew that wants to leave zero casualties, and that really is their motive. That's what they try to do. If they have to, they will do it, but their goal is to leave zero casualties and just come away with the loot that they want to get and not really bring anybody else into it. Wayne Groh is a part of this crew. He's essentially a hired gun. He's a hired mercenary. He's not really a part of Macaulay's core crew, which really centers around three guys.
He's not in the Rolodex.
Exactly. It's Chehurlis, it's Chirito, and it's Trejo. And those are the three guys that he trusts. But they do bring in hired guns from time to time to be able to do their specialty. And Wayne Groh is ruthless. He's a guy that will not stop. And Macaulay knows it. He knows it, but he still hires him for this job. Ultimately, it ends up costing them in this situation because they're ready to get this job wrapped up, taken care of. Wayne Groh looks at a security guard that's there, obviously from the blast and from all the gunshots and the gun firings. He's completely lost his hearing at this point. The two lock eyes, and it's really the security guard in this. I don't know his name because he's just not, you know, provided.
Yeah, he's uncredited.
Even in the credits, I don't think there even was a credit or whatever.
No.
But credit to whoever this guy is, because he just looks at Wayne Groh with this sheepish look like, I have no idea what the hell is even going on here. It's just, it's a look of disbelief. And Wayne Groh misinterprets this as he's engaging me. He's gonna pull a gun on me. And Wayne Groh pulls a gun out and shoots this guy in cold blood. As a result of that, when this guy is dead, all of a sudden now it engages the rest of the security guards. They pull out their guns and Neil's crew has to do what they have to do. They execute the rest of them. And that sets the tone for the movie. Now all of a sudden, Macaulay knows that he and his crew are going to have a huge target on their back because now they've killed civilians. Now they've killed guys that were responsible for public safety.
Made it a capital crime.
They made it a capital crime, and the cops are going to be all over this now. Now he knows that there's heat around the corner, and that really dictates how he makes his decisions throughout the rest of the movie, Murph.
It really does. And the first order of business is to, you know, they get away from the Brinks heist, for lack of a better word, because they were taking down a Brinks truck. And, you know, they meet for coffee later, and you can feel the tension in the room. Macaulay hasn't gotten there yet. And once he does sit down, he lets Wayne Groh know in no uncertain terms that he was, you know, not happy with him. Wayne Groh is the only one sitting there, you know, eating his pie and drinking his coffee and nice and relaxed because the man's a sociopath. There was no reason to kill this guy. They ended up having to kill two other guys just because of him. And Macaulay is pissed. So what he's doing is he's like, you know, it's going to take a few days, but I want to pay this guy off and cut him loose. And they walk out to the parking lot and it's a hit. They're planning on killing him. They want to eliminate this problem right now. This is how professional this crew is. If you screw up, you know, if you do the job right, you get paid. And maybe you get a phone call later for another job. But right now, no, you screwed up. So you got to go, because this is the type of guy that will sell. Macaulay knows. He knows that this is the type of guy, if the heat comes, he's going to sing and he's going to do whatever he can to walk out, because he doesn't care about anybody or anything except for what he's got in front of him.
Completely untrustworthy.
Right. So they're going to freaking put him in the trunk of a car. They pop the trunk and it's lined with plastic, with garbage bags. So, you know, there's going to be no trace. You know, every step you take, you find out how professional these guys are. This is not a joke. These are career criminals. These are the guys that when they go to jail, they sit at the head of the table. They're at the top of the pyramid. They aren't in there sticking up grandma and grandpa for, you know, what's in the cigar box down at the bodega. That's not what these guys do. These are high end criminals. And they were going to take care of this problem as soon as they can. And then Waingrove ends up getting away because there were a couple of patrol cars or something that happened to go through a parking lot. And that moves the story along.
Absolutely. And it does. And all of a sudden, Waingrove gets away. The police cruiser comes by. They're distracted. And then they look down and they realize he has been able to wriggle away and get away. And Macaulay knows this problem is eventually going to come back to bite him. But there is bigger fish to fry at that point, and he needs to go ahead and get to that next level. So he goes to see his fence, and his fence is a guy named Nate, who is played by John Voight, who originally John Voight actually did not want to be in this movie. It's not that he had anything against Michael Mann or the movie, but he figured that there were other guys that could play the part better, that would be able to, you know, get a little bit more of a role. And probably Voight looked at it and said, it's not a huge role. What am I going to commit to this film for? But Michael Mann was so determined to work with John Voight that he pleaded with him to take the role, and he did. And I think Voight took a great part in this, and I think he was always, again, always a guy that does what he needs to do and gives a great performance no matter what he's in. And again, I think he did that. Nate suggests at this point that stolen bonds that they were able to get from this heist, that he should sell them back to their original owner, and that is money launderer Roger Van Zandt. And Murph, you had mentioned Van Zandt a couple of times. William Fichtner is the guy who plays Roger Van Zandt. For those of you that don't know, he is a character actor, again, that you've seen in tons and tons of movies. One of his more prominent roles, I guess, would be as a detective in a TV show called Prison Break, which was on Fox. The reason why I know that is because it was the lead into 24, and I used to watch that along with 24 in my college and early 20s days. So, but Bill Fichtner has been in a lot of different movies. He was in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles remake with Michael Bay. He's been in a lot of different, he had a couple of bit parts, and he actually was in the beginning of The Dark Knight with Christopher Nolan, who, believe it or not, Nolan actually credits his portrayal and his depiction of Gotham City from this movie. He actually takes a look at how the city shots were taken, and if you watch the films and you watch them side by side, you can actually see it, especially in The Dark Knight. It's very very eerie, and a lot of shots that he uses in the city shots, especially where there's action and there's chases and gunshots throughout the film. That's very interesting to see if you can see the similarities. So Nolan credits this as one of his favorite films of all time and used that as an homage in The Dark Knight. So a little bit of a connection there as well.
He's great. He's great. He's great. Didn't Mann do Armageddon?
He did. Yes.
He was also in that. He played a colonel in Armageddon. Another great movie.
Exactly.
But no, a lot of directors, a lot of producers, they like to use the same actors in some of their movies. You know, you worked with them before, just like a crew, and you bring them back. And he is a fantastic character actor. And every time I see him, all I can think of is, you know, they're here so you won't freak out on the asteroid.
Right.
Oh, man. So, all right, get us back where we belong.
No, I think we're good. And Van Zandt, and basically the reason why Nate suggests that they sell the bonds back to Van Zandt in the first place is to profit by claiming the insurance on the bonds. And Nate figures that Macaulay and his crew will be subject to some of that, and they can double the value or whatever and make even more money than they had originally made. So at that point, Van Zandt agrees. But again, every character in this film has a fatal flaw, a tragic flaw. And Van Zandt is that he believes he's going to outsmart this crew.
Right.
He's going to outsmart the
criminals. He's
smarter
than everybody else.
He's smarter, exactly. He wears the white shirt and the dark suit to work every day, unlike these common thugs that are out there doing his bidding on the streets of Los Angeles. not the case. But this is what Van Zandt feels. There's a lot of ego going on there. So he tells his men, ambush McCauley and kill them at the meeting when they're going to do the exchange. Well, McCauley's a little smarter than that, and his team is ready. He has Chehalis ready with as a sniper. He has these guys all set, and they feel the ambush coming. They can sense it. They're ready for it. They're hoping it wouldn't happen, but when it did, they were absolutely ready for it, and they jumped on it. And all of a sudden, McCauley's character calls Van Zandt and says, I'm talking to a dead man. There's a dead man on the other side of this phone. And then you see the paranoia of Van Zandt comes out. Mm-hmm. Now he's scared out of his wits. He's sleeping in his office at one point. He's, you know, taking drastic measures, which is a real drastic measure, which we'll get to in a minute. I don't want to get too far ahead here, but that's where McCauley's crew is now. Now they have to take care of Van Zandt. They have to try to make another score to be able to sustain the type of lifestyle that they have. They also have Wayne Grow out there in the lurch, and that's going to come back and be tied together very quickly as well. But Murph, you mentioned the two crews. These two crews are a mirror image of themselves. And on the flip side of this, Vincent Hanna, LAPD, and his crew now enter the fray, and now we see their antagonists. And McCauley's crew is going to be going against Hanna's crew. And there are definite mirror images of these two crews coming together. Hanna is like McCauley. He's relentless. He will not stop. He is going to pursue you until he gets his man. And you can see that in the part that Al Pacino plays. He's a very talented detective. He can pinpoint exactly. He takes a look at the crime scene where the three security guards were killed, and he can pinpoint right away exactly what happened. And rattles it off in about 2 seconds flat.
He does. It's fantastic. He looks at the first victim and he says, this guy did something, and then there was no reason to leave any witnesses after that. And this is what McCauley was afraid of, that as soon as somebody died, it went to Hanna. Okay, it went major case, and these guys were going to be working on it. Before then, it was just a bread truck robbery. That's it. That's all it was. And while that's something serious, this is major case. And this crew that, you know, that Pacino is running is the best of the best. This is L.A. in the late 80s, the early 90s, when it was the bank robbery capital of the world. It probably still is. But these are the kind of task forces that are put together in these major cities, because that's where these kind of things happen. And these guys are absolutely handpicked, you know, just like they are with McCauley. Fantastic mirror image. And this is going to be their focus until they bring these guys down or they disappear.
Right. And again, we talk about how precision McCauley's crew is. Hanna's crew is just as precision to doing what they do. And Murphy hit the nail right on the head when you said that. That's the mirror image of these two crews that are going head on head. Hanna immediately senses that there's got to be something up and that he's going to be able to use his informants to find out one of these guys and pinpoint them. And sure enough, he does. He finds an informant. He's able to go. He meets with him at a nightclub. And the name Michael Chirito comes up. And that automatically puts Hanna right in the thick of things. He does a little research. His team does a little research, I should say, and they discover that he is tied to guys like Chris Chehalis. And originally, they don't have much information on McCauley. That goes to show you exactly how good McCauley is at doing what he does. He's the leader and the kingpin of this, but he's the guy they don't have information on. So that goes to show you just how good he was at being able to control the narrative surrounding this team and be able to essentially command things at the head, and knowing that if someone had to go down, it was going to be one of his lieutenants. It wasn't going to be the king of the hill. And it takes a little bit of digging on Hanna's behalf and the team's behalf to find out exactly who McCauley is and what he's all about. But initially, that's not the guy they find out. It's Chirito, and then that leads them to Chris Chehalis, and then the surveillance starts.
That's it. The guys are all out together at a dinner or something, and Chirito is already under surveillance, and that's when they find out that, yes, he's running with these people. Let's get surveillance on everybody 24/7, on Chehalis, on McCauley, even though they don't know his name. They keep losing him. But once they find out who Neil McCauley is, and he's being followed – This is one of the greatest scenes ever. Pacino goes out. They've got surveillance on him. He jumps in his car and starts following Macaulay too, and he flashes him over to the side of the road. Am I jumping too far ahead for you?
No, you're not. I think you're jumping.
Okay.
There was a scene right before that where Macaulay's crew is going to be on a minor breaking and entering charge. They're trying to get jobs here and there to be able to enrich themselves. And Hannah's crew is right there, and they're in position. They're ready to nail these guys. And it would be a pretty decent size that they made off with what was in this building. This would have been a pretty decent score for them to be able to put them away. And there's a very minor sound that Macaulay picks up on that lets him know that he's under surveillance and they're about to be ambushed. And he walks away from the job. And again, we talked about this right at the opening of the show. He's not afraid to drop the ball and say, nope, done. I'm walking away and I'm leaving. At the same time, Vincent Hanna is savvy enough to be able to know that he can't pursue Macaulay and his crew, even though his guys are telling him, we got him right here.
They haven't done anything.
He's like, what are we going to do? Bring him in on a minor breaking and entering. They'll be on the streets in 2 days. It's not worth it. Let them go. You're going to let them walk, and
let
I'm going to continue to surveil them. And
you're
that's exactly what happens. And by that point, he finds out Macaulay's identity. And that leads to the scene that Murph is leading to. And probably
I'm sorry I jumped past that. Wow.
No, you didn't. I think you set it up perfectly. No, you really did. We were able to bring that back in, and I love it. So no need to apologize. Murph, you're the patron of the bar. You're the king of the bar, and we know that. But in any case, that sets up the scene that you were about to start describing, and I think the most iconic and really the most indelible scene of the movie. And that's the scene everybody's been waiting for, the showdown between Macaulay and Hanna, the showdown between Pacino and De Niro.
And this is the real showdown. It's not what we're going to talk about later on in this episode. It's right here. You know, Vincent pulls him over, and Macaulay, he just pulls it. There's a cop pulling me over. Okay. And he knows that he's under surveillance now, and he sees him get out of the car, and you see him adjust a gun under his leg because he's, we'll see what's happening here, but he's cool. He's not going to jump out of a car and start firing, you know, or anything like that because they've got nothing on him right now. He knows it. And that's when Vincent goes up to the car and he's like, why don't we go get a cup of coffee? Can I buy you a cup of coffee? And Macaulay's like, yeah, all right, let's get coffee. And they go and they sit down and they start talking. And it's the back and forth between them in this short period of time. I think it's got to be less than 5 minutes or 6 minutes when they explain to each other, you know, exactly who they are and what they're about. And the other one is not going to change that in any way, shape or form is just, it's breathtaking. It's mind blowing acting done by two guys that are at the absolute peak of their, I don't want to say their talent, but you know, at the peak of their careers. Both of them are probably still there, but I mean, at this point in time, these two on screen together is something that everybody who loves these kind of movies like Mike and I have been waiting for our entire lives.
Absolutely. Could not be better said, my friend, and it doesn't disappoint. If you're a fan of X's and O acting, this is the scene that you definitely want to watch in this movie. And you really do want to watch the entire movie because the movie is phenomenal. But just this scene alone could have gone on for 2 hours and it still would have been a masterpiece. That's how good these guys were. In an interview with Al Pacino on the DVD special edition, he revealed that for the scene in the restaurant, this scene between the two of them having coffee, it was De Niro's suggestion actually that the scene shouldn't be rehearsed because these two guys knew each other well. They were friends before the movie. They had talked about doing a movie together. This ended up being the one that brought them together, but they hadn't acted on screen together. And there was some unfamiliarity. And Robert De Niro suggested to Al Pacino, let's use that. I think we can use that to our advantage. Let's not rehearse this. Let's make this a little bit choppy and a little bit difficult because it's going to fit totally into the characters and what we need. And it really was. And Michael Mann agreed to it as well and said, I think you guys are right on to something. Pacino immediately agreed with him. And I think it worked wonders for the scene. Again, Murph said it. This is the first feature film to feature De Niro and Pacino acting together. That was the hype prior to the release. Again, for me, this was going to be the showdown between
yep.
the two great actors that you know, I had grown up idolizing.
It took my $7. That's
Absolutely.
What got my $7, you know, $7.50, whatever it was at the time.
Absolutely. I went to see this in the theater. I was, I think, 14 when this movie came out. So it was big for me to be able to see this in the theater. It was something that my mother and father were comfortable to take me to the movie theater to see, because I wanted to see it with them, because my
really?
Father and I had watched, we had watched Pacino movies, you know, over and over. And, you know, I was always a big fan of his with The Godfather. That was something there where, you know, I had become a very big fan of that in the last few years. So to see these guys on screen was something I wanted to share with my dad. And my mom was a big Pacino and De Niro fan as well, so she wanted to come to see
That's
this.
Great.
It was great, and it did not disappoint. For this sequence, a little bit of background here before we get into the significance to the movie. For this sequence, it was actually filmed with two cameras simultaneously, and that was done by Michael Mann to generate a greater level of fluidity between both rivals. Since there were no rehearsals for the scene, this approach, for having the two cameras, it gave them a little bit more freedom to be able to be spontaneous. And in one of the scenes, one of the back and forths, you can see the two of them start to break up a little bit and laugh. It was actually very organic, and it fit mm-hmm. well into the scene. They were actually laughing with each other. It's probably Al Pacino and Robert De Niro sharing a little bit of a laugh, saying, yeah, we're really nailing this scene. We really, really did it.
Yeah.
But it fits very well into the characters as well, and the two developing a like for one another, despite the fact that they're on different sides of the law, and one of them
right.
is going to have to go down at one point, and they both know this. And at that point, it becomes difficult for them to do. This actually took place at a real restaurant in Los Angeles on Wilshire Boulevard, believe it or not, in Beverly Hills. The name of the restaurant was Kate Mantellini. That was the name of the coffee shop and the cafe that they met. It was known as kind of like a late supper spot in Beverly Hills. So it fit the narrative. Seeing these two guys having a late night coffee there was something that millions of people had done within the Los Angeles area. Believe it or not, they capitalized on this for quite some time. They had a sign that had the word heat that they put in the window to let people know this is where De Niro and Pacino had coffee. As a matter
no
of fact,
kid.
They never took reservations, but they used to get thousands upon thousands of calls a week from people that were going to be visiting the area that wanted to reserve that table. As a matter of fact, it was table 71, according to the owner and proprietor of the cafe. And
oh,
they were
great.
Absolutely happy. They were. They were happy to see people at the table, but it was first come, first serve. They couldn't do reservations. Otherwise, these reservations would have been booked, they said, many years in
right.
advance. You would have probably had maybe like a minimum 3 to 4 year wait to get this table if you wanted to reserve it. So if you got there and you timed it just right, you could sit at that table. The restaurant unfortunately did close in late 2014, so it's no longer in existence. But for a while, they rode that coattail of the fame that they got.
I bet
got
that booth
and,
somewhere. I
yeah,
bet that booth
absolutely.
Is somewhere.
Yeah, and
you know?
That's something I could not find. I actually did do a little research on this to try to see if that set
Dude,
or that
the
booth
best.
Or the table was. I couldn't find much on it. I'm sure there is there. I got to do more digging. Maybe I'll update our patrons here at the bar the next time we take the microphone. But I'll keep digging on that. But I haven't been able to find out.
Probably in
what...
the former owner's basement or something. And it's just oh God. God, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's got to be somewhere, but, you know, I'm closing shop, but I'm taking this booth with me.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I would do the same thing, and I would have that
mm-hmm.
at my disposal whenever I wanted it. And that'd be one of those things where you would hate to sell it. I just want that in there, saying, Pacino sat here, De Niro sat there. Yeah, what better could I possibly have for a piece of a movie memorabilia than something like that? But basically, this is really, I think, the turning point of the movie. This is now the scene that puts everything in place. Now, Pacino knows, or I should say, Hannah knows Macaulay. Macaulay knows Hannah. They sat face to face. They've talked back and forth. Again, like we said, they develop a like for one another. They develop almost a not a friendship, because that's definitely the wrong
Just
type
a,
of word.
A healthy respect.
Exactly. They've developed a respect for one another. You can probably see seedlings in that, you know, before they even met. You know, I think Hannah respects Macaulay's attention to detail and just how good he is at what he does. It's almost like, damn, that son of a bitch is good at what he does. I can't nail him because he is just so good. And Macaulay has to respect Hannah's perseverance and his, never say die attitude. And so there is definitely respect, but now there's actually a little bit of a like between these two guys. But again, it comes back to it. The two of them know that they're either going to never see each other again, or it's going to come to a head. There's not going to be a situation where these two are going to ever be able to coexist after this job is done. And that is the big job that Macaulay and his crew want, which is a huge score that's going to set them all up for the rest of their lives.
Really is. They're going to, you know, they. This is when technology first started becoming a huge part of crime, modern technology, you know, the internet, the waves, and John Voight, who played the fence, and it introduces Macaulay to a to a high tech expert that, you know, can filter out messages that are sent through the air, for God's sakes. They're just put out over the air through dishes, you know, and he knows where the money is coming from and where the money is going and where it's going to be dropped, and De Niro likes what he has to say. He set up this job for him, and he's pitching it to him. Do you want to take this job? This is the job that's going to set them up for life. This is going to take care of Chris's family for the rest of his life, because Chris, unlike De Niro, did fall in love with Ashley Judd, and they have a child. And this is leads into how things went badly, along with, you know, Wayne Grove and everyone else. But they take this job, and this is the score that Vincent is going to take down Macaulay on. And what happens at the we're kind of building to the climax, because we keep looking at the clock, folks, and we've already been here for an hour. And I don't want to turn this into a five-hour thing and bore you to tears. I'm not sure how this movie could, but that's what happens, and that's how, you know, Vincent finally gets to the point where he finds an inroad, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, he does. He finds an inroad, and essentially at this point, it's setting up now what's going to end up being the final showdown between these two crews. Vincent's crew is ready. They know what's coming. They know the target. They know when. And at the same time, Macaulay knows that Vincent knows that he's ready to go. It depends on which crew is going to be better.
They just don't know where.
Get the jump. Exactly. And they just don't know where yet. They know where. Well, they know the time. They know when they're going to be able to do this and what's coming. They just need to know where. And they're doing the best to be able to do that. And it's a chess match back and forth to see which one of these guys can get the better of each other and come out on top of this heist. Lost in all of this, and we haven't even really gotten into this, and I'll just briefly kind of give a background. There is a personal background here going on with Vincent Hanna's family and also with Macaulay and a young woman named Edie that he met at a bookstore where he used to go in and research information about metals to try to find what he was going to be able to exploit and weaknesses in some of the metals that he was able to use in explosives and whatnot. Edie, played very, very well by Amy Brenneman, who actually didn't want to do this movie when she first read the script. She thought it was gory. She thought it had no moral, ability to be redeemed. And Michael Mann only thought that made her even more perfect for this role. So Amy Brenneman did take a great role in being the innocent, naive young woman that just wanted someone to spend her life with and didn't realize the level to which this guy was involved in criminal activity. On the flip side, Hannah is, I think it's his third marriage to Justine, that is completely falling apart at the seams. Not because of love, the two obviously love one another, but he's just never there. He's never, ever there. He's always pursuing his first love, is getting the collar, basically, is being able to put the cuffs on these criminals, and he becomes essentially obsessed with getting Macaulay because he's so good. He wants to be able to take him down. Now, Justine has a daughter that's not Hannah's daughter, but it's his stepdaughter, and that's played by Natalie Portman, who really, I think, gives a great performance in this film.
Yeah.
You can see the seedlings of what type of a great actress Natalie was about to become. Plays a very troubled teenage girl. Her father is absentee, constantly makes plans with her, cancels them. She takes it personally, and she suffers from a very, very bad bout with depression. That's an underlying theme here throughout the movie. And Hannah really takes to this girl. He loves her as his own. You can see it. You can see the concern and just the genuine sorrow that he feels for her, that her own real father continues to play with her emotions and essentially throw them in the garbage at every chance that he gets. So he's trying to hold together some familial ties, knowing that there is going to be a time down the line where he's going to retire from this and he's going to want something more out of his life, but he just can't let it go now. It's not in his makeup and personality to be able to let that all go. At the same time, all of a sudden, De Niro's character in Macaulay has something now that's taking his, because he starts to have feelings for this woman, Edie. It's not so much easy for him to be able to walk away from her anymore.
Right.
That does come to a head. And we'll talk about that. But let's talk about a little about this this showdown in the streets of Los Angeles. A brilliantly filmed scene, Murph.
Yeah. What the guys do, as I just mentioned, is it's a bank heist. That's in Mike just mentioned. That's going to set them up forever. Now, while they're waiting to go in, Danny Trejo does not show up for the job. He is being tailed. He can't lose these guys. And when Macaulay is talking to him on the phone, he gets a phone call from him. He says, I can't shake these guys. I'm sorry. The last thing I want to do is let you down, man. But what am I going to do? I'm going to drive up there and the cops are going to be with me. And that's when, you know, he's in a diner doing this, and he sees somebody that he's known from his past, a guy that has done time and could probably handle the driving aspect. Now, Danny's going to be the driver on this job, and he pulls him out. He pulls out Dennis Hibart, who plays Donald. He's just a guy out on parole, dealing with an asshole as he's a dishwasher. Dealing with an asshole who's making him kick back money to him to keep his job. And, you know, this is the way it is. You don't like it, you know, go find something else. Talk to your parole officer. This is the way it is. And this is how you start back out. And Donald is just fed up. He's done. And when De Niro asks him, do you want to get the hell out of here? I got a job, but I need to know right now. He says yes, and he goes with him. So they head off with, you know, you can tell that De Niro is a little, you know, hesitant about going into this job with you know, somebody that he's sure about but hasn't been in on anything. And they head to this bank. They walk in loaded to the teeth. I mean, there's a clip out there, people, of a bank robbery back in the 80s where these guys had been knocking over banks. This is in real life, and they take on the LAPD with M16s. They're dressed in complete body armor. And I don't know if this movie came first or if that came first. I can't really pin down which happened first, but They are mirror images of one another. They walk into the bank. They walk out without firing a shot. Vincent gets a tip that this is where things are going down, and him and his crew head to the bank as these guys are already in it and starting to come out with just bags and bags of cash. We're talking $15, $20 million, maybe $50 million in cold, hard cash. And that's when, you know, the firefight starts. Why don't you jump in?
Yeah. And the firefight does start, and it really, really is an amazingly filmed scene, to be honest. And Murph kind of alluded to this earlier about the crew taking on the LAPD with M16s. They were so precision in what they did that Val Kilmer has actually stated in interviews that his ability to reload the automatic weapon is actually shown in instructional videos to the U.S. military of how you need reload your how you need to reload your magazines and be able to go on the fly in quick, difficult situations. This is a part of that instructional video, and they show how he's able to do it and what they should do, and he's very, very proud of that, as I'm sure he should be, and he, and he is. You know, that really is interesting. So that gives you an opportunity to see how Michael Mann went into great depth to be able to make sure that this was authentic and it was realistic. And obviously, if the U.S. military is using it, folks, it was.
But this
is a firefight that comes down into the streets of Los Angeles. Hannah's crew is there. They know now where he's going to be, and they start with the firefight. And Chirito is fatally wounded during this fight. You can see him at one point. He actually, in a moment, I'm sure, of just desperation, picks up a child, runs with him. So that way there's no ability for him to be hit. But the LAPD's marksmen are very good at what they do. They're able
to take
out.
A good family man who scoops up the freaking six-year-old girl to
exactly.
Use his, you know?
Exactly. And he loses his mind. He just completely does. Everything to that point tells you that this guy is somebody that may not be a monster, but again, in the heat of the moment, good people can do indecent things, and that's exactly what happens. Chirito, for that, pays the ultimate price. He's gunned down and killed in this. Churlis is gunned down, but he's not killed. De Niro and his team are able to collect him and be able to take him to Nate to get him some medical attention. The driver, Donald, that Murph had originally alluded to, Dennis Haysbert, he ended up being shot and killed in this exchange as well. Donald's character, Dennis Haysbert, actually is another face that you know from so many, from the Allstate commercials. Again, another 24 connection. He played President David Palmer in 24.
Yeah.
Probably the best of the presidents on the 24 series. He played Pedro Serrano, of course, in Major League. So he's got a long, long resume. Just a great character actor. Brilliant in everything he is. And again, he was great and perfect in this film. But that firefight stops Macaulay in his tracks, but they do get away, and they do have the ability to move the money that they need to. They were able to salvage that and get away with some. Now what he needs to do is get out of the country, and that's when he goes to Nate and tries to make these arrangements, and you start to see seedlings of the personal relationships that these two rivals have.
Right.
Sort of derail the fact that they may get one final showdown. We mentioned that Hannah's daughter, his stepdaughter, had a terrible bout with depression after the raid, and he basically comes to the realization that Macaulay is so good, we didn't get him, we're not going to get him, folks. He's gone. He's not going to, there's no way that I'm going to get another crack at him. That's it. I'm going home. I'm going to the hotel. I'm going to take a shower and a nap, and I'm just going to forget this whole day even happened. He gets to the hotel room, and there is his stepdaughter lying in a pool of blood, basically, in the bathtub. She's tried to commit suicide. Hannah is frantic. He grabs her, ties her wrists, does the best he can to tie a tourniquet, takes her to the hospital, and luckily, it looks like she will be able to get through it. Her wounds are not serious enough. She didn't bleed out enough in the bathtub to be able to warrant her being, killed, but at this point, she's going to be in a bad way. His wife, his estranged wife now, joins him at the hospital, and it looks like this is where Hannah's going to be for the rest of the day. But again, there's things lurking out there. And Murph, if you want to just go into a little bit of detail on what finally happens with Wayne Grove and how he comes back into the mix here, because that ends up leading to the ultimate downfall of Neil Macaulay.
Well, Wayne Grove is on the hunt. He is now working for Van Zant. He knows this crew. He tells Van Zant is camped out in his office, and he meets Wayne Grove, and he puts Wayne Grove to work for him to take out this crew, because he knows that whether it's now or 2 weeks from now, he's going to end up dead if these guys aren't. Now, Wayne Grove starts hunting down members of Macaulay's crew. Now, the first one that he takes out is Danny Trejo. Why can't I remember the name of his character right now? It's just Trejo.
Actually,
Trejo in the movie. Yep. But he hunts him down. Now, first off, De Niro's a little, you know, sketchy as to why things went bad. And the first thing he does is he looks who was there and who wasn't there. And Trio wasn't there. So he thought he got picked up and he might have turned on them. He goes to take care of Trio, but he already finds him beaten up and near death. Out of him, the only thing that he really got out of him was the word Waingrow. So
right.
Macaulay knows where this came from. Macaulay's going to hunt Waingrove down. Waingrow has now turned state's evidence. Before Macaulay leaves, he actually does Trio a solid and freaking, you know, puts a bullet in his head to end his suffering. That's it, you know, okay, walk away, boom. And then he finds out somehow what hotel the police who now have him are hiding him out in. And before he leaves, he's got to tie up this loose end. There's two loose ends. One is Edie, because he doesn't want to leave without her now. And two is Waingrow. So he takes Edie with him on his way out of town. They stop at this hotel, and he's trying to figure out how to get to him when he's being protected by so many people. He pulls a fire alarm. So, of course, you know, what happens when you pull a fire alarm? There's a little bit of chaos going on. A little pandemonium.
Exactly.
Just yep. What he needs. So he gets to Waingrow, takes him out in just spectacular fashion, just the way the dog deserves to die. And then he's headed back out through surveillance or whatever. Everybody else is running around, and Al Pacino, who plays Vincent, you know, he did walk away from his responsibility. You just walk away. He hears that this is going on. He gets to the scene, leaving his stepdaughter in the emergency room with his wife. It's don't walk away. Don't have anything in your life that you can't walk away from in 5 seconds. Macaulay broke this rule. Vincent is still living by it. The job calls,
absolutely.
I'm gone. Macaulay let it get personal on two fronts, and that seemed to be his downfall.
Yeah, and for all the movie, you look at these two characters, and you look at Hannah, and it looks like Hannah's going to be the one that has the personal ties, especially with the terrible thing that happened to his stepdaughter. You look at him and say, well, he's the guy that's not going to be able to walk away. Macaulay really doesn't have anybody. He's not married to this woman. He doesn't have children. You know, his Chehalis is now going off, and he's going to have to live his own life and cut ties completely from his wife, his daughter, and possibly, and of course, Macaulay. But Macaulay at this point is the guy that ends up not being able to walk away. It becomes too personal, especially much more so the murder of Waingrow becomes much more important than Edie.
And Van Zandt.
He takes out
Van Zandt too.
Exactly. He does take out Van Zandt, and that's very, very interesting. And that's where he tries to find out where Waingrow is, and that's how he ends up finding that out. Van Zandt gets taken out. Waingrow gets taken out, but ultimately it's the taking out of Waingrow that was one step too far. After Van Zandt, he had Edie in the car. He very easily could have driven, gotten away, gotten to the getaway plane, which is what he tried to do with Nate had set him up. He was going to set him up. I believe it was going to be a new life in Ireland. I think it was going to be in the outskirts in the hills of Ireland that he was going to go to. But ultimately, Macaulay was not able to let that go. And because of that, Hannah doesn't let it go either. He's able to pursue Macaulay. He knows where he's going to be. He knows what he's going to do, and he's waiting for him. And when Macaulay comes out of the hospital, the hotel, he sees Edie sitting in the car, actually smiles, which Macaulay's character only smiles, I think, like 3 or 4 times in the movie.
Yep.
That's how dedicated this guy is to being serious about his craft. He briefly smiles, but then he spots Hannah shuffling through the crowd, and he knows that he's not going to be able to get away. And at this point, now he's got to leave everything behind. He walks away from Edie. Edie's sitting in the car looking at him going, where the hell is he going? What's going on here? He's running away from me. She has no idea what she did or what happened in that hotel room to warrant him just walking away. But the pursuit happens. Macaulay is trying to get away, and a very brilliant ending scene here. Very, 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 very well filmed. with Anna picking up on slight movements of a shadow. He discovers where Macaulay is, and the two of them pull their guns. Hannah was quicker on the draw than Macaulay was, and he's fatally shot by Vincent Hannah. And the two of them lock eyes. Macaulay looks up at him and says, "I told you I was never going back." And the two actually hold hands, believe it or not, as yep. the life just drips from Macaulay's body. And Hannah is left as the victorious of the two. But it literally took everything the two of them had. They both, at that moment, lost everything to pursue one yep. another. And ultimately, it was the cop that came out on top in this one.
And the only person that walked away from it, I want to say unscathed, is Chris, who had
yes.
the deepest ties, who his ties had refused to turn on him when it was, you know, the police were in her. They knew that Chris was part of this. The police had already been on to her in a segment that we didn't really get to, just to keep this under 2 hours. you know, he's driving past his wife Charlene's apartment, and she's standing on the balcony. The police are watching. They're at both ends of the street, and she just tells, you know, waves her hand to tell him to keep moving, just keep going.
Right.
And he does get away using an alias, and they had checked him at the end of the street. She was worried that there were going to be shots fired and everything, but no, he just took a right and drives off into this, you know, for lack of a better word, the sunset, and that was that. This was
yeah.
The term that we keep going back to is being able to walk away from something. Mm-hmm. The women weren't able to. Macaulay wasn't able to. Pacino, everybody who broke the rule ended up worse for
price.
The wear.
you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
Thank you. Paid the price. I'm searching
yeah,
for words here, and
price.
I shouldn't.
Whether
I'm sorry. I'm
was,
done with my notes, people.
But no, in all actuality, it wasn't really even a price that maybe they should have paid or had to pay, but
right.
it was a price they did pay. And again, you know, you got the, you felt for, in that moment, that was probably, I think, the most personal moment in the movie, even more so. I mean, that was just a horrific moment when you see Pacino and you see Hannah carrying his stepdaughter into the hospital. You can see mm-hmm. the horror in his eyes, the worry. He loves this girl very deeply and does not want to see her. But I think the most personal connection in this film is the scene that Murph just described, which is the look that Ashley Judd gives Val Kilmer and the look that he gives back to her. He sees her standing on the balcony. His face lights up like a Christmas tree. There's my wife. I'm going to be able to be with her. See, I
yep.
cut my hair. I'm ready to grow up. I'm ready to leave this all behind. I'm going to do what you want me to do, and they can't do it. The two of them obviously love one another very deeply, but she loves him so much to say, you have to go. You have to get out of here. Otherwise, they're going to arrest you. I'm not going to betray you. And that's exactly what happens there. Is there a chance that the two of them reconciled afterwards and were able to find one another? Very, very slim, folks. I would probably
right.
say there's little to no chance that that happened simply because of the surveillance and what happened. I guess it could. I mean, if you want to think
yeah,
that way.
Yeah, I mean,
think
I'm sure he figured out a way to get his wife and child some money every month and,
yeah.
and take care of that. But I don't think that, you know, no, I really don't. It kept a window open, a crack for everybody to think about. But I don't think that they were spending Thanksgivings together.
Probably not. And that is ultimately a tragedy of the movie, where everyone invested so much into
yep.
the job and into being professional that most of them, if not all the characters in the movie, ended up losing everything that really meant something to them. Most of them, it was their lives, but a lot of the characters, it was just these indelible things that were in their lives that just did not continue. So, Murph, The Bar absolutely had a great, great viewing of this one, and we hope that we were able to give you a little insight and maybe some tidbits you didn't know about the movie. But if you haven't, if you did get to the end of this explanation and you haven't seen the movie, we hope that we've inspired you to be able to go check it out, because it is one of my favorites, it's one of Murph's favorites, and we absolutely loved this film. And it was an honor to break this down with you, my friend.
It really was. It was a blast, buddy. You know, I love coming here and doing this. Folks, we really enjoy it. Thank you for voting in the polls. Like I said, this is a movie I never turn past when I see it on, or, you know, I try to, if I do see it on TV, I see if it's on, you know, pay-per-view and get the real cut of it, not something that's all cut up. Please check this movie out, folks. Please, if you haven't seen it, it's something that will make you sit up at the edge of your seat almost the entire time, just for the dialogue alone. It's fantastic. And Michael, I want to thank you for opening the bar up every couple of weeks when we come here and do this, and just being the perfect partner in you know, discussing some of our favorite movies and what is downright the best genre that has ever, you know, graced the silver screen, man. I just love doing this, and I love doing it with you. Thank you so much. Put a bow on this, and let these people get back to their lives.
Absolutely, my friend, and I couldn't have said it better myself, and I assure you the feeling is definitely mutual. Sharing the microphone with you, doing this, no matter what we do, it's always fun, whether it be football, sports, but this is a genre that really does tug at the heartstrings of myself and my good friend Thomas Murphy here, so we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. I appreciate being able to share the microphone with a good friend and discuss a genre of movies that we absolutely love. So please be sure to check us out on the Shape at B-Mod Pod. Definitely follow us on Twitter, myself at MDABATEFDC, my friend Murph at TMurph207. Watch for our Twitter accounts. That's where we'll be updating you on the next subject of the Shape Ify Mob Bar. We might be looking at, you know, possibly doing another poll, or we might just go back into the drawing board and say, you know what, we're going to do something that might be a little bit different than you expect. We're always about the unexpected here at the Shape Ify Mob Bar. But as for the Mob Pod itself, you can always catch it at Full Press Radio, downloadable on all of the platforms, whether it be
all
Apple Podcasts, Google Play,
we got an app,
Stitcher, Spotify. We have an app. Do it. Download it. You'll definitely love it.
It's free.
Absolutely, and it's free. How much better can it get? So, for my good friend Thomas Murphy, I am Mike DeBate. We are about to turn out the lights here on the Shea Bippy Mob Bar. We will be back within a couple of weeks to be able to chronicle in that time frame. Enjoy, and now, yous can leave. Have a great day, everyone.